Lights reflected off the murky green water and made the river look festive despite itself. About 100,000 people were strolling the flagstone banks past the fountains, stone bridges, and pricey new restaurants. The kitchen smoke of 10 or 15 different cuisines drifted up past the yellow and green patio umbrellas. Tourists with cameras and souvenir sombreros, basic trainees on leave, rich men with high-priced call girls, all happily stepping on toes and spilling drinks on each other. This is what a San Antonian thinks of when you say river. I remember how much trouble I had reading Huck Finn as a child, trying to imagine how the hell that raft made it past all those restaurants and crowds in water only 3 feet deep and 30 feet across without anybody noticing the stowaway slave. Maybe that's why I became an English major, sheer confusion. Maya held on to my hand so we didn't get separated. In one of the rare moments when there was enough room for us to walk side by side, she pointed at the river and said, "I want to eat on one of those." A dinner barge went by, a huge red shoebox lid with an outboard motor. 50 tourists smiled and raised their margaritas from the white linen tablecloth. The waiters looked bored. "No, you don't," I told her. The operator in back turned the outboard just enough to avoid an oncoming barge from a rival restaurant by a few inches. "Do they ever collide?" Maya shouted at me over the crowd. "Only when the operators are bored, which is most of the time." Occasionally, people fell in, too. My father used to keep a record of how many drunk tourists he'd personally fished out of the river working the fiesta duty. I think he stopped counting at around 23. I was surprised how many of the older restaurants had closed. The Union Jack umbrellas of Kangaroo Court were still up. Jim Cullum's Happy Jazz Band was still swinging at the landing like the 1920s had never ended. But almost everything else had changed. We settled for a riverside table and a mediocre plate of nachos at a place simply called La Casa. I should have guessed we were in trouble when I saw the name. I knew it for sure when I asked for Herradura Añejo, and our waiter told me they didn't carry that kind of beer. Fortunately, the people watching was better than the food. A group of blue-haired women in evening dresses and summer minks went past, trying very hard to look glamorous while the sweat was trickling down their necks. A family of Goodyear blimps stopped long enough to stare jealously at our nachos. Two nuns in full black regalia and fluted hats ran by, screaming in German, followed closely by a group of very drunk and very naked pinheads, followed closely by the SAPD beat patrol. The crowd opened and closed around the chase. A few people laughed, then more drinks were ordered, and life went on. "Is it like this every night?" Maya asked, clearly impressed. "Saturdays it usually picks up." "I should hope so." Before it was full dark, we headed back toward the white tower of the Hilton Palacio del Rio. 10 stories of balconies looked out over the water, most of them lit up and overflowing with partying college kids. The main bar at river level was doing a brisk business tonight despite the entertainment, 3 scruffy musicians falling asleep into their microphones over a very slow rendition of Amy. When we got to lobby level, I'd been planning to bribe the concierge anyway. It was just a bonus that I found an old high school chum behind the desk. Mickey Williams took one look at me and gave me the warm greeting I'd been expecting.
"What the fuck are you doing here?" he said.
Mickey was the closest human equivalent to the Pillsbury Doughboy I'd ever come across. He had no skin pigment to speak of, and his hair was so yellow it was almost white. He was big, all over, an overinflated kind of big, and although he looked soft, in our days at Alamo Heights, I'd seen plenty of high school fullbacks bounce off Mickey's body without leaving a mark. I'd never quite gotten up the nerve to poke him in the stomach to see if he would laugh. I had a feeling he wouldn't. Mickey had also dated Lillian for a brief time when we'd broken up our senior year, until I'd stolen back her heart. Or rather, until I'd stolen Mickey's pickup. Lillian's very brief flirtation with kicker dancing in general, and Mickey in particular, had come to an abrupt halt when they'd had to walk halfway home from the Blue Bonnet Palace in Selma.
"Mickey," I replied, grinning. He looked at me suspiciously. His pasty face flushed red. Then he tried his line again. "What the fuck are you doing here?"
"Came to see you, old buddy." He looked behind him. Probably he was checking for the hidden camera.
"Go away," he said. "I like my job."
"Come on," I said. "That was a long time ago."
"I didn't work for a fucking year after that time at Maggie's."
Maya smiled, not having a clue what we were talking about. I shrugged as innocently as I could.
"How should I know Miss Pac-Man could pick up so much momentum going down one flight of stairs?"
Mickey appealed to Maya.
"Fucker destroyed 3 booths and nearly killed the general manager."
"I didn't make you push it."
"Just tip this up while I look for my quarter," he quoted.
I shrugged and took out 250s. I put them on his desk. "I'll get out of your way as soon as you tell me which room Mr. Carnow's in tonight." Mickey stared. I smiled and set down another 250s. Mickey looked down very briefly.
"You want the keys too?" he said.
Chapter 46.
"Carnow," said Mickey. "Room 450. Books that suite every week and pays in cash."
He slapped the keys into my hand.
"And Trace, you fuck with me?"
I smiled. "Would I do that?"
"Shit."
Mickey shook his head like his job was as good as lost. We watched the door to 450 from the service closet at the end of the hall. The door stayed put. The freshly vacuumed maroon rug in the hall outside was devoid of footprints. Then somewhere around the corner, at the end of the hall, another door opened and closed. The man who walked across the hall and into the stairwell was wearing jeans and a striped Baja shirt with the hood pulled up. He was moving briskly. Maya and I exchanged looks.
"A suite," she said.
451, I said. We raced each other down the hall. Maya's gun was out by the time she stopped at the door. I threw her the keys and pushed into the stairwell, not even sure who I was following. From the echoes, he was about 2 floors below me, going just fast enough to get the hell out without someone thinking he might be running. I'll say one thing for my worn-down deck shoes, they're quiet. I managed to follow him down without giving him reason to speed up. When the blue-striped Baja exited on the Riverwalk level, I was only 20 feet above him. I came out into a service hallway and dodged a fat tourist in a sombrero. I almost knocked a margarita pitcher out of the waitress's hand as I ran into the bar. The comatose folk trio was now doing the funeral dirge version of Cat Stevens' greatest hits. Baja Man still had his hood up. He was navigating through the patio tables outside, heading into the crowds. I stayed 20 feet back as we moved down the Riverwalk. Baja didn't look back. The paseo was so narrow and thick with people, I couldn't get an angle to see his face. We passed the Market Street Bridge and kept going toward La Vallita. For a minute, I lost Baja behind a slow-moving Oompa band. They had Pride of Fredericksburg stitched into their green Bavarian breeches and painted on the side of their tuba. But they sure weren't in a hurry to get to whatever performance they had in mind. It's usually worth the time just to hear German spoken with a Texas twang, but not when you're chasing somebody. I finally got rude and shoved past. The guy with the hairy white legs and the bass drum almost went into the river.
"Goddamn scheiß, Carol!"
he shouted after me. The one with Johann on his feathered hat tried to bean me with a handful of funnel cake. From the squeal behind me, I assume it hit a nearby call girl or debutante instead. I kept moving. The music changed from polka to full brass mariachi as we rounded the corner and crossed another bridge, then ducked through an alleyway and into the Arneson River Theater. We had somehow come up on the performer's side. There was a concert in progress, like there is most nights. The spotlights were on, the band's ponchos were technicolor, and their horns were well polished. Across the river, the old stone seats of the amphitheater were almost full. Baja stopped for a minute, considering his options. Then he sped up. So did I. That's when I made the mistake of running into another old friend. Slamming into an old friend, actually. Carolyn Smith was directing the KSAT mobile camera on its tripod at the wrong moment to catch a particularly enthusiastic crowd response to my favorite tune, Guantanamera. What she caught instead was my shoulder as I tried to squeeze past. That in itself probably would have been okay, but as I kept running forward, she stepped back to get her balance and executed a beautiful piece of unintentional taiji. Her leg went under mine, and my foot stopped. The rest of me kept going. A lot happened in that 5 seconds. Carolyn looked up and recognized me.
Trace, she said.
She probably didn't mean to yell it so loud, but part of that was shock as she realized a few hundred pounds of camera equipment was starting to topple. Then she realized the camera's power cord was wrapped around her ankle, and she was toppling with it. I didn't even have time to wave at the other TV station's camera before the two of us and the KSAT mobile unit went headfirst into the river. Considering it was the first day of August, the water was downright chilly. The bottom was so slick with algae, I fell down the first 3 times I tried to stand up. It didn't help that Carolyn was trying to climb to safety over my body. As I stood up in the crotch-high water, the crowd erupted in applause. The mariachis, gratified by the response, launched into my second favorite tune, La Bamba. I waved, feeling like a fresh mound of bat guano and smelling just about as good. Not being deaf, the man in the Baja shirt had noticed me. By the time I located him, he'd already decided it would take too long to fight his way through the crowds to the bridge. Instead, he took a more creative exit. He made the jump onto the first dinner barge and stood precariously on the center table while 50 tourists spilled their margaritas. The waiters and operator no longer looked bored. Since the second barge passed only a few inches away, heading the other direction, it was a short jump to that for Baja. More drinks spilled, another group of German nuns in fluted hats, possibly the same ones I'd seen earlier, looked up to see a man on their dining table. Then he was gone, sprinting up the steps of the Arneson River Theater. His hood came off just for a moment as he dodged through the tourists with all the grace of a former athlete. Long enough for me to notice that Dan Scheff had gotten a haircut since we'd talked last. Then he reached the iron gates at the top of the amphitheater and disappeared into the darkness of La Vallita. Carolyn was yelling at me as she slipped and slid over to the riverbank.
"What the hell do you call that?" she demanded.
The guy at the KENS camera offered a suggestion.
"I call that a take."
Chapter 47. Fortunately, Corporal Hearns remembered my father. Unfortunately, Hearns was among the majority of the SAPD who had hated my father's guts. It took me some serious tap dancing and a grudging admission from Carolyn that perhaps I was not a rabid lunatic before Hearns agreed not to lock me in detox.
"Maybe I did step back at the wrong time," Carolyn mumbled.
"Wrong time," I said. "Hell, I want you to teach me that move, Carolyn." Her fine blonde hair had turned into greenish licorice cords in the river. She pushed a few strands out of her face and smiled despite herself. I tried to visualize her as the reclusive computer nerd I remembered from our journalism classes at A&M. But all I saw was a TV model with a babyish face, nice lips, and fashion contacts that had come loose and were slipping into her corneas like dark blue eclipses.
"Carol Lane," she corrected me.
"What?"
She tried to straighten her once white blazer. "I'm a media personality now, or at least I was until you ruined my spot. I go by Carol Lane."
"Is it Smythe instead of Smith?" She frowned. If she hadn't been over 25, I would have called it a pout.
"I've heard that one too many times."
"Sorry." I stood and made my apologies to the cameraman. He just stared at me. I thanked Corporal Hearns for his time and compassion. I left Carol Lane my phone number so we could talk about the damages.
"Hey," she said, "what in the hell is your hurry?"
I looked behind me at the Hilton and thought about Maya and her 45 alone in Beau Carnow's suite.
Or maybe not alone. Duty calls, I said.
Great, said Caroline. See if I share my bath towel with you again.
It was difficult to look dashing as I sloshed down the river walk, leaving a trail of puddles, but the smell cleared a path for me pretty effectively. I waved at Mickey as I jogged past the Hilton concierge desk. His mouth dropped open and stayed that way while the elevator doors closed. The door to room 450 was closed, but Maya opened it before I could even knock. When she lowered the gun out of my nostril and stood aside, I saw why she looked so grim. The room decor was straight out of Versailles. Champagne chilled on the dresser in a silver bucket. The balcony curtains opened onto a perfect summer night sky, and all the lights of the Paseo del Rio. The man in the bed was wearing his best velour robe and his comfiest slippers. He lay back, totally relaxed, with two black eyes and the red mark of an East Indian on his forehead. Only Beau Carnau was neither East Indian nor relaxed. He was just dead. In Maya's other hand was a bottle of Veuve Clicquot. She sat down next to Beau and took a swig, then she looked at me. Only the way she breathed shallowly from her mouth told me that she was pretty unnerved, and only because I knew her well. Otherwise, her face might have been made of polished wood, for all the expression she revealed. I took a soggy index card out of my back pocket, the message Guy White had given us that afternoon. I said, "Nice of Mr. White to invite us up tonight, don't you think?" I sat down on the other side of Beau. His ponytail had been loosened so that his hair had opened up around his head like a black and gray peacock tail when he fell back. The bruised skin around his eyes was shiny and purple. He had a slight, wet smile on his face, like somebody had just told him a funny but tasteless joke. Thank God his viscera hadn't loosened up yet. There was no smell. "It was Dan," I told Maya. "I lost him."
"You still think he's not a player?"
I didn't feel like arguing the point. On the dresser was Beau's photo portfolio, open to the first page. The article, "Dallas Native Follows Dream," had been carefully removed from the plastic and stuck onto the mirror, maybe where Beau could see it when he woke up every morning. Next to that was a black-and-white photo of 19-year-old Lillian, smiling over her shoulder at the photographer, her mentor. Her eyes were full of adoration. On the floor at my feet was an open, empty CD case. It was cracked as if someone had stepped on it.
"Someone finally got what they wanted," Maya said softly, "without a payment."
"Half of what they want," I corrected. Maya handed the champagne over Beau's body. Beau didn't request any. I finished just enough of the bottle to belch the nausea out of my system. Only then did Maya seem to notice my appearance.
"You're wet," she said.
"Don't ask." Maya nodded, not in the mood to argue either.
"White gets us here," she said. "Dan leaves us here, and your friend Mickey knows where we are. We can't just walk away."
When I didn't respond, Maya went to the phone and calmly made three calls. First to the house detective, second to Detective Schaefer, third to Byron Ash. "Got any plans tonight?" I asked. Neither Maya nor Beau seemed to. The Hilton chief of security, a large black man named Jeffries, took one look at Beau, then helped us finish off the champagne.
"I don't get paid enough," he said.
Then he sat down on the Louis XIV chair in the corner and started mumbling into his walkie-talkie. Two patrolmen arrived, then the detectives, then forensics. Tape went up, the media arrived, maids, interested guests, everybody but the jugglers, the nuns, and the dancing bear. Detective Schaefer finally came dragging in too, looking as usual as if he'd just woken up.
"Take these two into the next room," he told a uniform, "black and white." And we did.
Maya's favored status with Mr. Ash must have been running thin. An hour after she called him, we discovered that Lord Byron would be declining a personal appearance. Instead, a junior associate, who looked about 15, showed up and introduced himself
as Haas. Haas smiled. Shaking his hand was like squeezing a damp Kleenex.
Don't worry, Haas said. I come highly recommended from Mr. Ash. I've handled several criminal actions.
Schaefer decided to notice us then.
He lumbered in with red eyes, managed not to bump into anything, then stared at each of us in turn.
He took out a handkerchief and blew his nose slowly, meticulously.
Okay, he grumbled. Tell me it's a coincidence.
Before we start, said Counselor Haas.
Schaefer and I exchanged glances.
He comes highly recommended, I told Schaefer.
Schaefer looked sour.
So did my ex-wife.
Haas smiled like he got it. We made ourselves at home in King Louis's love seat while Schaefer sent a uniform downstairs for a garlic bagel and some herbal tea.
Red zinger if they've got it, he said.
I stared at him.
What? He said. You want some?
I quickly declined. Schaefer made that snoring sound again, and it finally occurred to me why he always looked and sounded half asleep. It was terminal sinuses.
Cedars?
I asked. His nasal passages ground like ball bearings.
Damn pecan trees. That yellow stuff gets all over my yard. I forget breathing for 3 months. It's a healthy lifestyle.
Now, detective, Haas started, if we could just...
Schaefer looked at him, and he shut up. Schaefer liked that.
This guy from Ash?
He asked Maya. Maya nodded. She tried not to smile. Schaefer liked it even more. After that, Haas participated about as much as a tennis spectator. I had the feeling he would have held Schaefer's handkerchief for him if asked.
Okay, Schaefer said. Let's hear it.
So we told him. Sort of. I did a bad job feigning surprise when Schaefer told me that Terry Garza, the man I'd been arguing with when Moraga's corpse was delivered through the wall of Chef's office, had also been killed. I told him about the anonymous note we'd gotten to come to the Hilton, and how I'd chased a guy from the room who I couldn't ID. Maya described how she'd found the body. I told Schaefer I hadn't fired a gun since I was a kid and certainly not at Beau Carnow's head this evening. Maya asked if we were being charged with something. Schaefer explored his nostrils with his handkerchief one more time.
How about stupidity? He suggested.
Too late, Maya said. My client's nolo contendere.
Your client? Objected Haas.
Shut up, we all said.
The uniform came back with Schaefer's tea and bagel.
All they had was sleepy time, he reported.
I thought Schaefer would demote him on the spot, but he just stared into his tea and sighed. Now he really did look tired.
So let's run through this, he said. A week ago, you asked me to check into confidential files. You've suddenly discovered your father has been murdered 10 years ago. CID's on my butt inside 5 minutes for even fielding your call. Then we've got 3 homicides in the space of 3 days, and you just happen to be around for all the fun.
2/3 of it, I objected, without much conviction.
Yeah, Schaefer grunted. So there's absolutely no connection. I should just take some more Sudafed, crawl into bed, and not worry about it, huh?
Maya and I glanced at each other. My nerves must have been more shot than I figured. I was close to leveling with Schaefer.
Listen, detective.
Then my mind stopped and rewound what I'd just heard. I changed my tack.
When you said CID, you mean Rivas? As in the creep who showed up at your investigation that night at Chef's offices?
Schaefer scowled.
As in the Cambridge disappearance? Maya added.
As in Lillian Cambridge, I said. The present stiff's studio partner?
Schaefer wadded up his handkerchief while he thought about that. Whatever he concluded, he didn't let it show in his face.
That doesn't matter, he said.
His look said the opposite. What I want.
Whatever he wanted, he was distracted when Jay Rivas walked into the room. Rivas sported a newly combed mustache and a silver and turquoise belt buckle the size of a grapefruit.
"Navarre," he said, "back again, just like a fucking yo-yo."
Rivas was in a good mood tonight. You could hear it in his voice. After he lit a cigar over the protests of the forensics crew, he studied everybody in the room, finally nodding to Schaefer.
"Can I help you, detective?" Schaefer said without enthusiasm.
Rivas came up to me and stuck his face in mine, like I was some kind of weird exhibit. His wandering eye drifted merrily downstream. Then he sat on the arm of the love seat directly above Maya and put his hand on her shoulder. Maya didn't flinch. Her eyes examined Rivas's hand clinically, like she was locating all its breakable bones and pain-inducing pressure points. Rivas shifted, a little uncomfortably. The hand moved.
"Detective," Rivas said to Schaefer, "could I get a few minutes with Mr. Navarre and his friend?"
Schaefer stared at Rivas, then at me. Maybe he remembered what my mouth had looked like after I accidentally hit it on the door last time Rivas wanted a few minutes, that night at Chef Construction. Or maybe Schaefer was just pissed off because his sinuses felt like a worn-out transmission and the Hilton was out of Red Zinger. Whatever it was, he made a decision.
"I got a better idea," he told Rivas. "You could explain what you're doing in my homicide investigations. All my homicide investigations."
Rivas glanced at his audience. When he spoke to Schaefer again, it was much more polite and much colder.
"Maybe we could discuss this outside," he said. "That's a good idea," Schaefer said. "You go ahead. I'll be out as soon as I send these people home."
Rivas got up.
"Send them where?"
All of a sudden, Schaefer looked much better. I guess the Sudafed had kicked in. He shook Counselor Haas's hand.
"Damn fine work, Counselor. Y'all stay in town. But that's it for tonight."
If Haas had acted any more like an ecstatic puppy, he would have peed on the carpet. We filed past Rivas, who seemed to be silently assessing Schaefer as a possible rifle target. I shook Schaefer's hand. I shook Haas's hand. I even shook the assistant coroner's hand. I probably would have shaken my old school chum, Mickey Williams's hand, too, but he was in the general manager's office getting a talking to when we walked by.
"Mickey," I called.
He looked up dismally.
"You need a good lawyer?" I asked. "He comes highly recommended."
Chapter 48. We'd been sitting on the steps of La Faita Chapel for so long, staring at the empty building that used to be the H.O. Emano Gallery, that I thought Maya had gone to sleep. The adrenaline had worn off. With my clothes slowly drying and my nerves shot to hell, I felt as frayed and greasy as the corn husk off a tamale. Then we both looked at each other with something to say.
"You first," I said.
"No," Maya said.
"It's just..."
"Beau waited a little too long to run," I said. He was still trying to salvage the scam. He let somebody into his hotel room, sat down to barter for the disc, then, whoever it was, shot him in the face. She nodded. And he wouldn't be so relaxed if he was bargaining with the mob.
"So, we've got a dead blackmailer," I continued. "The second disc missing, Dan Chef looking guilty as hell, and Lillian still missing."
An elderly tourist couple walked by. The old woman smiled at us the way people do at lovers in the shadows of a summer night. Then she stared sadly at her oblivious husband. When Maya looked back at me with almost the same expression, it twisted my nerves a little tighter.
"What?" I said.
"Lillian's either dead or involved, or both? Is that what you want me to say?"
She almost got angry. I wished like hell that she would. Instead, she hugged her knees and stared out at the empty limestone shell of Lillian's studio.
No, she said. I didn't want you to say that.
What then?
You still want me to think my dad's death has no connection? The pictures of Halcombe are a coincidence? You want me to forget about it?
She shook her head.
I was just thinking about plane tickets.
It was my turn to stare.
Tickets? As in plural, tickets?
She took a pecan wood twig and poked at the mortar between the flagstones. The twig was so dry it broke into dust.
Never mind, she said.
Jesus, Maya, she nodded. You know I can't just leave town.
You never did leave town, she said. That's the thing.
Like hell. I tried to believe it. The fact that I didn't made me madder. A group of Mexican nationals went by, talking about their weekend of shopping. They smiled at us. We didn't smile back.
All right, I told Maya. You want me to feel like shit about you and me? Okay, I feel like shit. But I didn't ask for backup.
You didn't turn it down last night, she said. You should think about why.
Her eyes had turned to steel in the space of those two sentences. My face probably wasn't much kinder.
I counted the strands of lights. I watched the cars go down Nueva. I said,
so you're leaving?
Trace,
Maya closed her eyes.
Why are you staying?
You don't want to hear this again.
You saw the damn letters, Maya.
No, I saw a carriage full of dolls and a grown-up woman's bedroom.
Did it ever occur to you that you're the only piece of that collection Lillian Cambridge ever lost, Trace?
It was one of those moments when God hands you the emotional scissors and invites you to start cutting. Irrevocably. Instead, I just watched as Maya stood up and walked down the stairs. I don't know why, but as she passed, I caught the scent of the chapel's interior smoked into the porch beams, incense and very old wax. It was the scent of confessionals and baptisms and Las Posadas candles that had been snuffed before Santa Ana ever rode through town. When she was 10 feet away, Maya turned and looked at me, or maybe she just looked at the chapel. I felt like I'd already blended into the limestone.
Call me when it's over, she said, if it ever is.
She walked away, slowly enough to give me time to call her back. Then she disappeared behind the outer walls of La Vallita, heading up Nueva where the taxi stands were. Another old tourist couple passed by, but this time I was alone. Nobody bothered smiling kindly. The woman took her husband's arm. They shuffled a little faster. I got up and went across the courtyard to stare in the window of H.O. Emano Gallery, now filled with nothing but hardwood floors and moonlight and old ghosts.
Now what? I asked.
But it was a closed party. And the ghosts didn't have any time to waste on me. I pulled a wad of dead man's money out of my pocket and went to find the nearest bottle of tequila. Chapter 49. When my brother Garrett called the next morning, I'd been asleep about 14 minutes. Most of the night I'd sat cross-legged on the bathroom floor next to the toilet, rereading my father's old notebook and debating with Robert Johnson about the pros and cons of drinking white tequila by the pint. I don't remember who won the argument.
"You and Maya find the other disc," Garrett growled in my ear. "I can't do shit with this one."
Once I found my vocal cords, I told Garrett I had no other disc. Then I told him I had no Maya. My brother was quiet. In the background, Jimmy Buffett was singing about cheeseburgers.
"If I had legs," Garrett said, "I'd come down there and kick your stupid ass."
"Thanks for the vote of confidence," I said. The line was silent for a few seconds.
"So what happened?"
I told him. Almost as an afterthought, I read the four lines to Garrett that had been bothering me for days, the ones underneath my father's trial notes for Guy White. Savinow, get whiskey, fix fence, clean fireplace. Afterward, I could hear Garrett scratching his beard.
"So what?" he said.
"So, I don't know. I keep wondering how Dad might have gotten mixed up with the Travis Center deal. I keep remembering what Carl told me about some new lady in his life. You got any ideas?"
"Fuck it," Garrett said. "Get your ass back to San Francisco and forget it."
"If I had a dime," I said.
"Yeah, you ever wonder if all us poor schmucks who care about you might have a point?"
I didn't tell him how often. Finally, he grunted, probably rearranging himself in his chair, then called me a few names.
"Okay," he said. "Savinow, hell, he was there damn near every Christmas shooting the fucking Bambis. What's so unusual?"
"I don't know. That note just doesn't sit right. For one thing, he wrote it in April. You ever know him to go up in the spring?" He thought for a minute.
"Fireplace. Christ. Only thing that reminds me of was Christmas Dad stayed sober. Burning the furniture in the fireplace, that was a shitter."
A memory started forming.
"When was this?" "Way before you're talking about. You must have been in fourth grade, little bro. You remember the argument about the Lucchese chairs?"
Then it came back to me. Dad had been between terms as sheriff, meaning that he'd gotten voted out of office. My mom had blamed it on the booze, I guess, and Dad was making a real effort not to drink so he could get his campaign in shape for the following 4 years. So our first day up at the ranch for Christmas, he announced this, lined up all his liquor bottles on the fence, and shot them up. After that, all I remember him getting were more deer than usual and a very bad temper. After the second day, the trees outside the ranch house had more dead deer strung in them than the Christmas tree had ornaments. When that got old, my dad got his .22 and started hunting cats instead. Somebody had dropped a whole litter off in the country rather than put them to sleep, I guess, and of course they'd grown up feral and started eating all the quail on the property. So Dad went out and popped cats all day, then came home with a bloody bag full like Santa Claus the axe murderer, sank into his recliner, drank coffee, and scowled all night. By the time Garrett and Shelley joined us for Christmas dinner, Dad had just about run out of things to kill, and my mom and I were starting to get nervous. There'd been a stupid argument at the dinner table, something about who was going to inherit the dining room chairs. They'd been custom-made for my dad by Sam Lucchese, the bootmaker, right before Lucchese died. The argument ended with Garrett taking the chairs out back and grinding them up with a chainsaw for firewood. In the meantime, while my mom and Shelley sat consoling each other in the kitchen, I'd watched my dad pace around in the living room. He went over to the fireplace and lifted a huge chunk of limestone off the hearth. I hadn't even known it was loose. Then he took a fifth of Jim Beam out of the hole underneath and drank it almost empty. When he turned around and saw me, I was sure he was going to slap me across the back 40, but he just smiled, then put the rock back. He pulled me up on his knee and started telling me stories about Korea. I don't remember the stories. All I remember is the smell of the Jim Beam on his breath and the sound of that chainsaw going in the backyard. Finally, Dad leaned close and said something like,
"Every man's got to have a stashing hole, son. A man tells you he's shot up his whiskey good and permanent, you'd best be sure he's either got a stashing hole full somewhere, or he's a damn fool."
Then he helped Garrett load the fireplace with Lucchese chair legs. By the time it was over, they were joking together. I never said a thing about the stashing hole. I think I'd forgotten about it until now.
"Clean the fireplace," I said to Garrett.
"I'll be damned."
"What about it?" he said.
I was probably still drunk from the night before. It was a stupid idea. On the other hand, my other option was to spend the day thinking about dead people, missing people, and Maya Lee.
"What?" said Garrett. "I don't like it when you get quiet."
I watched the water swirl into patterns as it washed down the bathroom drain. Jimmy Buffett was still jamming in Garrett's office. "Who's got the keys to the ranch?" I asked. Garrett swore. "I do, you know that." I waited. "No way," my brother said. "You're a total fruitcake."
"Runs in the family."
He was silent.
"Probably. I could pick you up in a couple of hours."
Chapter 50. The Carmen Miranda took the long way, down Highway 90, Old Savinow Road. By the time we got there, I was half-stoned just from sitting next to Garrett. I'd heard Changes in Latitudes on CD-ROM continuous replay cranked and remixed through Garrett's computer in the back until I knew all the lyrics sideways. I'd had enough Pecan Street Ale to make my throbbing tequila hangover from the night before fade to a dull ache. There wasn't much that could bother me at that point. Nevertheless, it was hard to look at what the march of civilization had done to Savinow. "Aw, Jesus," I said. "There's a traffic light."
"Yeah," said Garrett. "They changed it from flashing yellow about 6 years ago."
I sat up a little straighter in my seat.
"What the hell happened to Ogden's?"
As a kid, I'd loved and feared the place. Every time we stopped at Ogden's for lunch on the way into town, I used to get scolded for trying to sit at the forbidden old-timers table in the back. Once, I'd had my ears pulled good. From that time on, I just watched from the counter, while the old men diced to see who would pay for the morning's coffee. My father would order the world's greatest chicken-fried steak sandwiches to go from a waitress named Merle. Now the diner was closed. The Hill Country mural that was painted on the glass in front was faded and chipped. The lights were off.
"Man, you are out of touch," Garrett said. "They changed the name to the Pepper Patch years ago. Then they went seasonal. No business out this way. They just open up for the hunters now."
"How the hell do you know all this? You turning kicker on me?" Garrett seemed to like that idea.
"Sometimes I need a place to get away. Doesn't get any more away than Savinow, little bro."
We passed the Chutes land. Then a few smaller spreads of mesquites, olive-colored hills, cows. Few old ranchers leaning against their fence posts turned to watch the mound of plastic tropical fruit drive by. One of them raised his roll of spare barbed wire in a salute. Garrett honked. The old wagon wheel, across from the entrance to Navarre Land, had always been our landmark for finding which gate was ours. Now the restaurant was boarded up. Our cattle guard hadn't been hosed out in so long, it was filled 3 feet deep with dirt. Our cattle were walking back and forth over the bars, grazing the side of the highway at will. One of them, a Charolais mix, was right in the gateway, staring down the Carmen Miranda.
"How about honking at it?" I said.
"No way," Garrett told me. "They're tame, man. You honk your horn, they come running to be fed. You ever seen a safari bus crowded by 33 hungry Charolais? Ain't pretty."
"How about a red cape, then?" I suggested.
Garrett just leaned out the window and had a heated discussion with the heifer. I guess it was paying attention because it finally moved out of the way. Then we drove through, trying to find the driveway under the prairie grass. The ranch house itself hadn't changed much since the 1880s, when it had been the homestead for the Nunley family, one of the founders of Savinow. Just 3 rooms with limestone walls and hardwood floors, rough-cut beams holding up the ceiling, more or less. My grandfather had grudgingly agreed to get electricity in a septic tank when he bought the land after the original Nunley spread had been divided back in the 1940s. But neither the plumbing nor the wiring had been touched since then. These days the septic tank was called Old 90, because you could only flush the toilet or take a shower once every hour and a half without everything overflowing. I was a little surprised to find Harold Dilberto standing on the porch waiting for us. "He still takes care of things out here?" I asked.
"Yeah," said Garrett.
Harold had taken the job when he was still married to my sister Shelley. He'd been abusive, drunk most of the time, and not very energetic. But he'd been family, he knew about cattle, and he'd been cheap to hire. I'm not sure which was the biggest selling point for my father. That had been 10 years and two of Shelley's husbands ago. I looked at the house, the cattle guard, the lawn that had turned back to prairie grass. "Doing a great job," I said. Garrett shrugged. "He's okay when his friends don't get him drinking." "What friends?" "Me, usually." Harold looked like he and the cows had been partying pretty hard the night before. His shirt was buttoned wrong, so his collar stuck up on the right side. His jeans were half tucked into his boots. At one point, his third-grade teacher had probably told him, "You make that face at me and one day it'll stick that way." She'd been right. Harold always looked like he was trying his best to look ugly. He nodded at me like he'd just seen me last week.
"Trace, Garrett?"
Garrett took the stairs on his hands, then pulled his chair up after him. The chair probably weighed 50 pounds. Garrett used one arm without straining.
"How's the well?"
he asked. Harold scratched a rash on his neck.
"Got the pump working, but it'd been a few days. Cattle stampeded the trough soon as it was going." "Great."
Garrett lifted himself back into his seat and led us through the door. I looked around while Garrett and Harold talked maintenance. Except for being dirtier and older, the place had hardly changed. The Army Corps of Engineers elevation drawing for Highway 90 had turned brown on the living room wall. The coffee table we'd gotten for Christmas from the Claybergs down at King Ranch still had boot marks on it from the last time my dad had propped his feet there. There was still a metal pail full of cricket lighters sitting in the corner from 15 years before, when the Western Union had derailed in the middle of town. Before the Army Reserve had come in to guard the trainload of new Toyotas that had spilled unexpectedly into downtown from the accident, everybody in Sabinal had already helped themselves to the smaller dumped cargo. 3 boxcars full of lighters. Sabinal still didn't have a single Toyota on the streets, but it was a good place to go if you needed a light. I wasn't quite ready to look in the fireplace. Instead, I sat on the couch. I traced the old boot prints on the table. Finally, Harold went out to shoot a rattlesnake he'd seen in the back field. Garrett wheeled his chair up next to me. He handed me a warm beer out of the chair's side pocket and lit another joint.
"So you checked?"
he asked.
"Not yet."
He took a noisy inhale. Together, we sat and looked at the limestone fireplace for a while, like it was getting great reception. A Cowboys game, maybe, deep in the fourth. I stood up.
"Look," Garrett said, "just don't expect anything, okay, little bro?"
"Okay." I moved the rock and looked in the stashing hole. No Jim Beam. Nothing but dark. Mortar. A few daddy long legs hanging dead. Then I stuck my hand inside. The hole was almost a foot deeper than I thought. I brought an old business-sized envelope into the light. My back was to Garrett. After a while, he couldn't stand the silence.
"Well?" he said.
The envelope had faded from pink to brown, but the original letter was still inside, written on pink stationery that after all these years still smelled faintly of strawberry potpourri. I read the first few lines, then turned and let Garrett see Cookie Chef's last letter to our father.
"God damn," said Garrett.
"Does your mouth taste funny?" I asked. "Kind of like metal." Garrett nodded, then wheeled his chair around to leave.
"And the bastard didn't even leave us any bourbon to wash it down," he grumbled. "Fucking typical."
Chapter 51. After reading the letter several times, Garrett and I either needed to get seriously drunk or do something to take our minds off what we'd learned. We opted for both. First, Harold put us to work worming 33 head of cattle. I'd like to say there was something cathartic about it, but there wasn't. I had the privilege of clamping the victim's head between metal bars while Garrett pumped a wad of paste that looked suspiciously like KY jelly into the side of the cow's mouth. If you've never seen cattle gag, don't go out of your way. When we were done, we sat on the porch drinking Harold's cheap booze and watching the evening come down over the plains. The sunset was orange, except when you looked at it through a liquor bottle, then it was brown and yellow. On the way back to town, Garrett and I cranked up the Jimmy Buffett. Occasionally, we'd look at each other, then decide not to talk. We both had the letter from the fireplace memorized now, and phrases of it kept gnawing at me. Protests that my father had used Cookie, searched her husband's private files, and only thus found incriminating documents about Travis Center. Pleas not to break her heart with a public scandal that would destroy her family. Promises that Dan Scheff Sr. really wasn't to blame. The Cookie would help my father find out who was responsible for using Scheff Construction to embezzle millions. Fervent affirmations of her love, kept from open admission by her duty to her son, to her sickly husband. The letter implied that my father had made Cookie a deal. Leave her husband and have the Travis Center issue forgotten. Garrett was bothered by it as much as I was, though his way of dealing with it was to curse at the semis on the highway and flip off the snowbirds in their RVs as he zoomed past them.
"Learn how to drive, sheep dip!"
he shouted at an old man whose license plates were from Wisconsin. Garrett leaned so far out his window, with no legs for ballast, that I was afraid he was going to disappear into the wind. Then he gave the finger to another semi that wouldn't let him pass. The trucker blasted his horn. "You ever get worried somebody's going to get pissed at you?" I asked when the noise died down. "Somebody with a gun?" Garrett shrugged. "It's happened. I'm still here." We drove for a little longer before Garrett looked over at me again. This time he decided to talk about it.
He was going to do it, wasn't he? The son of a bitch was going to ditch a major investigation for a woman. Another guy's wife, no less.
The Hemisphere Tower appeared on the horizon, sticking up from the orange glow of the city. I stared at it instead of answering Garrett's question. I wanted to deny the obvious, but the letter was pretty clear.
"Maybe he wouldn't have," I said.
"For a woman," Garrett repeated. "You know, I guess I always had one consolation, that he might have been a bastard and he might have screwed up his family, but at least he was honest about doing his job. He was the guy in the fucking white hat. Never mind." I shifted uncomfortably in my seat. "Maybe he meant to make it public. Maybe he died for it anyway, little bro." There wasn't much I could say to that. We cranked up the Buffett a little louder and rode into the smell of sulfur springs that always marked the southern entrance of either hell or San Antonio. Gary Hales was standing in the front yard of number 90, watering the sidewalk with a garden hose. He watched without expression as Garrett's van pulled up in front and I hopped out of Ms. Miranda's airbrushed blouse on the passenger side. Garrett's horn honked to the tune of Coconut Telegraph. Then the mound of plastic pineapples and bananas shuddered as he put the van into first gear and lurched off toward Broadway. It didn't seem to wake up Gary much at all. When I walked up, he raised his finger listlessly as if he wanted to say something. After waiting for a few seconds, I remembered it was August 2nd. "The rent," I said.
"That'd be fine," said Gary.
He shuffled a few steps behind me as we went into the in-law. If Mr. Hales had been harboring any last hopes that I was indeed an honest and upstanding young man, I managed to shoot them right to hell when I handed him a wad of $50 bills from my kitchen drawer. "No checking account yet," I explained.
"Huh,"
Gary said. He peeked over the kitchen counter at the drawer, which was now closed. He looked disappointed. Maybe he was expecting some assault weapons. Then the phone rang.
"Been ringing now in 30 minutes now," Gary said. I reckon I'd answer that.
Gary waited. The phone rang. I reminded Gary where the front door was. Then, when I'd herded him out, I picked up the receiver.
Jesus, Navarre, where in Christ's name have you been?
Carlin, I said. Behind him I could hear glasses clinking, Motown music, the sounds of a bar.
All right, Navarre, I agreed to 24 hours, not 48. You put me off last night, man, and 2 hours later Carnow gets whacked, dead bodies, cancel our deal.
My stomach twisted.
Carlin, if you printed something, shit, man. This is getting unfunny. Help does not include doing time as an accessory to murder.
So you haven't gone to press with this? He laughed without much humor.
What I've done is put in some footwork for your sorry ass. So, you want to know where Dan Sheff Jr. is right now? Getting himself schnockered on Lone Star. Or you want me to go ahead and start the interview without you?
Where are you?
Some private dick, Navarre. You have a little patience. You do little stakeout time. Where the hell are you?
Little hips. I'll be there in 10 minutes. Better make it 5. I got some serious questions to ask the man, and I might just...
I was out the door before he finished the sentence, hoping that in 5 minutes I wouldn't have a good reason to break Carlin's face.
Chapter 52. Little Hips wasn't so much a San Antonio landmark as it was a surrogate landmark. When L.D. Hips' original bubble room got demolished to make room for hospital parking spaces back in 1980, L.D.'s son opened Little Hips across the street and inherited most of the Hips' menu and paraphernalia. Despite the fact that the orange aluminum exterior made the bar and grill look like a drive-through beer barn, the inside was faithful to the bubble room. Multicolored bubbling Christmas lights, license plates, tinsel and neon, netted beach balls, and 1950s pearl ads hanging from the ceiling. Major League tacky. You could get Hank Williams or Otis Redding on the jukebox, Shiner or Lone Star gimme draws for pocket change, and Shy Poke eggs. Round nachos with Monterey Jack whites and Longhorn yolks, the jalapenos hidden underneath. The whole place was maybe 60 feet square. The after-dinner crowd was sparse, mostly off-duty medical workers and a few assorted white collars. I spotted Carlin McCaffrey at a table by the barber's chair. He was dressed in what he probably thought was camouflage. Dark glasses, khaki shirt and slacks, and a tie with only 3 colors. As I started over, he shook his head, then pointed at the bar. Dan Sheff occupied one of the 3 stools. He was hunched over a line of empty Lone Star bottles, ignoring the bartender's attempts at conversation. Dan's custom-made business suit was rumpled, and one of his hand-stitched shoes was untied. He looked like he'd slept in his car last night. A Taiji principle. If you don't want someone to run away from you, run away from them first. Become yin to make them become yang. I'm not sure why it works, but almost always they'll follow you like air filling a vacuum. I walked up to Dan and said, I'll be over there.